Whirligigs. I. The World and the Door. A favorite dodge to get your story read by the public is to assert that it is true, and then add that truth is stranger than fiction. I do not know if the yarn I am anxious for you to read is true, but the Spanish purser of the fruit steamer El Carrero swore to me by the shrine of Santa Guadalupe that he had the facts from the U.S. Vice Consul at La Paz, a person who could not possibly have been cognizant of half of them. As for the adage quoted above, I take pleasure in puncturing it by affirming that I read in a purely fictional story the other day the line, "Be it so," said the policeman. Nothing so strange has yet cropped out in truth. When H. Ferguson Hedges, millionaire promoter, investor and man about New York, turned his thoughts upon matters convivial, and word of it went down the line, bouncers took a precautionary turn at the Indian clubs, waiters put ironstone china on his favorite tables, cab drivers crowded close to the curbstone in front of all-night cafes, and careful cashiers in his regular haunts charged up a few bottles to his account by way of preface and introduction. As a money power, a one millionaire is of small account in a city where the man who cuts your slice of beef behind the free lunch counter rides to work in his own automobile. But Hedges spent his money as lavishly, loudly and showily as though he were only a clerk squandering a week's wages. And, after all, the bartender takes no interest in your reserve fund. He would rather look you up on his cash register than in Brad Street. On the evening that the material allegation of facts begins, Hedges was bidding dull care be gone in the company of five or six good fellows' acquaintances and friends who had gathered in his wake. Among them were two younger men, Ralph Merriam, a broker, and Wade, his friend. Two deep-sea cabmen were chartered. At Columbus Circle they hoped to long enough to revile the statue of the great navigator, unpatriotically rebuking him for having voyaged in search of land instead of liquids. Midnight overtook the party marooned in the rear of a cheap café far uptown. Hedges was arrogant, overriding and quarrelsome. He was burly and tough, iron gray but vigorous, good for the rest of the night. There was a dispute about nothing that matters and the five-fingered words were past the words that represent the glove cast into the lists. Merriam played the role of the verbal Hotspur. Hedges rose quickly, seized his chair, swung it once and smashed wildly down at Merriam's head. Merriam dodged, drew a small revolver and shot Hedges in the chest. The leading roisterer stumbled, fell in a wry heap, and lay still. Wade, a commuter, had formed that habit of promptness. He juggled Merriam out a side door, walked him to the corner, ran him a block and caught a hansom. They rode 5 minutes and then got out on a dark corner and dismissed the cab. Across the street the lights of a small saloon betrayed its hectic hospitality. "Go in the back room of that saloon," said Wade, "and wait. I'll go find out what's doing and let you know. You may take two drinks while I am gone, no more." At 1:10, Wade returned. "Brace up, old chap," he said. "The ambulance got there just as I did. The doctor says he's dead. You may have one more drink. You let me run this thing for you. You've got to skip. I don't believe a chair is legally a deadly weapon. You've got to make tracks, that's all there is to it." Merriam complained of the cold querulously, and asked for another drink. "Did you notice what big veins he had on the back of his hands?" he said. "I never could stand, I never could." "Take one more," said Wade, "and then come on. I'll see you through." Wade kept his promise so well that at 11 o'clock the next morning Merriam, with a new suitcase full of new clothes and hairbrushes, stepped quietly on board a little 500-ton fruit steamer at an East River pier. The vessel had brought the season's first cargo of limes from Port Limon, and was homeward bound. Merriam had his bank balance of $2,800 in his pocket in large bills, and brief instructions to pile up as much water as he could between himself and New York. There was no time for anything more. From Port Limon Merriam worked down the coast by schooner and sloop to Colon, thence across the isthmus to Panama, where he caught a tramp bound for Callao and such intermediate ports as might tempt the discursive skipper from his course. It was at La Paz that Merriam decided to land. La Paz the Beautiful, a little harborless town smothered in a living green ribbon that banded the foot of a cloud-piercing mountain. Here the little steamer stopped to tread water while the captain's dory took him ashore that he might feel the pulse of the coconut market. Merriam went too, with his suitcase, and remained. Kalb, the vice consul, a Greco-Armenian citizen of the United States, born in Hessen-Darmstadt, and educated in Cincinnati Ward primaries, considered all Americans his brothers and bankers. He attached himself to Merriam's elbow, introduced him to everyone in La Paz who wore shoes, borrowed $10 and went back to his hammock. There was a little wooden hotel in the edge of a banana grove, facing the sea, that catered to the tastes of the few foreigners that had dropped out of the world into the triste Peruvian town. At Cobb's introductory, shake hands with Dash, he had obediently exchanged manual salutations with a German doctor, one French and two Italian merchants, and three or four Americans who were spoken of as gold men, rubber men, mahogany men, anything but men of living tissue. After dinner, Miriam sat in a corner of the broad front galleria with Bibb, a Vermonter interested in hydraulic mining, and smoked and drank Scotch smoke. The moonlit sea, spreading infinitely before him, seemed to separate him beyond all apprehension from his old life. The horrid tragedy in which he had played such a disastrous part now began, for the first time since he stole on board the Fruiter, a wretched fugitive, to lose its sharper outlines. Distance lent assuagement to his view. Bibb had opened the floodgates of a stream of long-damned discourse, overjoyed to have captured an audience that had not suffered under 100 repetitions of his views and theories. "One year more," said Bibb, "and I'll go back to God's country. Oh, I know it's pretty here, and you get dolce far niente handed to you in chunks, but this country wasn't made for a white man to live in. You've got to have to plug through snow now and then, and see a game of baseball and wear a stiff collar and have a policeman cuss you. Still, Louisiana Paz is a good sort of a pipe dreamy old hole. And Mrs. Conant is here. When any of us feels particularly like jumping into the sea, we rush around to her house and propose. It's nicer to be rejected by Mrs. Conant than it is to be drowned. And they say drowning is a delightful sensation." "Many like her here?" asked Miriam. "Not anywhere," said Bibb, with a comfortable sigh. "She's the only white woman in La Paz. The rest range from a dapple dun to the color of a B-flat piano key. She's been here a year. Comes from, well, you know how a woman can talk, ask 'em to say string and they'll say crow's foot or cat's cradle. Sometimes you'd think she was from Oshkosh, and again from Jacksonville, Florida, and the next day from Cape Cod."
"Mystery?" ventured Miriam.
"And well, she looks it, but her talk's translucent enough. But that's a woman. I suppose if the Sphinx were to begin talking, she'd merely say, 'Goodness me. More visitors coming for dinner, and nothing to eat but the sandwiches here.' But you won't think about that when you meet her, Miriam. You'll propose to her too." To make a hard story soft, Miriam did meet her and propose to her. He found her to be a woman in black with hair the color of a bronze turkey's wings, and mysterious, remembering eyes that, well, that looked as if she might have been a trained nurse looking on when Eve was created. Her words and manner, though, were translucent, as Bibb had said. She spoke, vaguely, of friends in California and some of the lower parishes in Louisiana. The tropical climate and indolent life suited her. She had thought of buying an orange grove later on. La Paz, all in all, charmed her. Miriam's courtship of the Sphinx lasted 3 months, although Bibb did not know that he was courting her. He was using her as an antidote for remorse, until he found, too late, that he had acquired the habit. During that time he had received no news from home. Wade did not know where he was, and he was not sure of Wade's exact address, and was afraid to write. He thought he had better let matters rest as they were for a while. One afternoon he and Mrs. Conan hired two ponies and rode out along the mountain trail as far as the little cold river that came tumbling down the foothills. There they stopped for a drink, and Miriam spoke his piece he proposed, as Bibb had prophesied. Mrs. Conant gave him one glance of brilliant tenderness, and then her face took on such a strange, haggard look that Miriam was shaken out of his intoxication and back to his senses. "I beg your pardon, Florence," he said, releasing her hand, "but I'll have to hedge on part of what I said. I can't ask you to marry me, of course. I killed a man in New York, a man who was my friend shot him down in quite a cowardly manner, I understand. Of course, the drinking didn't excuse it. Well, I couldn't resist having my say, and I'll always mean it. I'm here as a fugitive from justice, and I suppose that ends our acquaintance." Mrs. Conant plucked little leaves assiduously from the low-hanging branch of a lime tree. "I suppose so," she said, in low and oddly uneven tones, "but that depends upon you. I'll be as honest as you were. I poisoned my husband. I am a self-made widow. A man cannot love a murderess. So I suppose that ends our acquaintance." She looked up at him slowly. His face turned a little pale, and he stared at her blankly, like a deaf and dumb man who was wondering what it was all about. She took a swift step toward him, with stiffened arms and eyes blazing. "Don't look at me like that," she cried, as though she were in acute pain. "Curse me, or turn your back on me, but don't look that way. Am I a woman to be beaten? If I could show you here on my arms, and on my back are scars, and it has been more than a year, scars that he made in his brutal rages. A holy nun would have risen and struck the fiend down. Yes, I killed him. The foul and horrible words that he hurled at me that last day are repeated in my ears every night when I sleep.
And then came his blows, and the end of my endurance. I got the poison that afternoon. It was his custom to drink every night in the library before going to bed a hot punch made of rum and wine. Only from my fair hands would he receive it, because he knew the fumes of spirits always sickened me. That night when the maid brought it to me, I sent her downstairs on an errand. Before taking him his drink, I went to my little private cabinet and poured into it more than a teaspoonful of tincture of aconite, enough to kill 3 men. So I had learned. I had drawn $6,000 that I had in bank, and with that and a few things in a satchel, I left the house without anyone seeing me. As I passed the library, I heard him stagger up and fall heavily on a couch. I took a night train for New Orleans, and from there I sailed to the Bermudas. I finally cast anchor in La Paz. And now what have you to say? Can you open your mouth? Miriam came back to life. Florence, he said earnestly, I want you. I don't care what you've done. If the world. Ralph, she interrupted, almost with a scream, be my world. Her eyes melted, she relaxed magnificently and swayed toward Miriam so suddenly that he had to jump to catch her. Dear me. In such scenes how the talk runs into artificial prose. But it can't be helped. It's the subconscious smell of the footlights smoke that's in all of us. Stir the depths of your cook's soul sufficiently and she will discourse in Bulwer Lytonese. Miriam and Mrs. Conant were very happy. He announced their engagement at the Hotel Oria del Mar. 8 foreigners and 4 native actors pounded his back and shouted in sincere congratulations at him. Pedrito, the Castilian-mannered barkeep, was goaded to extra duty until his agility would have turned a Boston cherry phosphate clerk a pale lilac with envy. They were both very happy. According to the strange mathematics of the god of mutual affinity, the shadows that clouded their pasts when united became only half as dense instead of darker. They shut the world out and bolted the doors. Each was the other's world. Mrs. Conant lived again. The remembering look left her eyes. Miriam was with her every moment that was possible. On a little plateau under a grove of palms and calabash trees, they were going to build a fairy bungalow. They were to be married in 2 months. Many hours of the day they had their heads together over the house plans. Their joint capital would set up a business in fruit or woods that would yield a comfortable support. Good night, my world, would say Mrs. Conant every evening when Miriam left her for his hotel. They were very happy. Their love had, circumstantially, that element of melancholy in it that it seems to require to attain its supremest elevation. And it seemed that their mutual great misfortune or sin was a bond that nothing could sever. One day a steamer hove in the offing. Bare-legged and bare-shouldered, La Paz scampered down to the beach, for the arrival of a steamer was their loop-the-loop, circus, Emancipation Day and 4 o'clock tea. When the steamer was near enough, wise ones proclaimed that she was the Pajaro, bound up coast from Callao to Panama. The Pajaro put on brakes a mile offshore. Soon a boat came bobbing shoreward. Miriam strolled down on the beach to look on. In the shallow water the Carib sailors sprang out and dragged the boat with a mighty rush to the firm shingle. Out climbed the purser, the captain and 2 passengers, plowing their way through the deep sand toward the hotel. Miriam glanced toward them with the mild interest due to strangers. There was something familiar to him in the walk of one of the passengers. He looked again, and his blood seemed to turn to strawberry ice cream in his veins. Burly, arrogant, debonair as ever, H. Ferguson Hedges, the man he had killed, was coming toward him 10 feet away. When Hedges saw Miriam, his face flushed a dark red. Then he shouted in his old, bluff way, "Hello, Miriam. Glad to see you. Didn't expect to find you out here. Quinby, this is my old friend Miriam, of New York. Miriam, Mr. Quinby." Miriam gave Hedges and then Quinby an ice-cold hand. "Brrrr," said Hedges. "But you've got a frapped flipper. Man, you're not well. You're as yellow as a Chinaman. Malarial here? Steer us to a bar if there is such a thing, and let's take a prophylactic." Miriam, still half comatose, led them toward the Hotel Oria del Mar. "Quinby and I," explained Hedges, puffing through the slippery sand, "are looking out along the coast for some investments. We've just come up from Concepcion and Valparaiso and Lima. The captain of this subsidized ferry boat told us there was some good picking around here in silver mines. So we got off. Now, where is that cafe, Miriam?" "Oh, in this portable soda water pavilion?" Leaving Quinby at the bar, Hedges drew Miriam aside. "Now, what does this mean?" he said, with gruff kindness. "Are you sulking about that full row we had?" "I thought," stammered Miriam, "I heard they told me you were that I had." "Well, you didn't, and I'm not," said Hedges. "That fool young ambulance surgeon told Wade I was a candidate for a coffin just because I'd got tired and quit breathing. I laid up in a private hospital for a month, but here I am, kicking as hard as ever. Wait, and I tried to find you, but couldn't. Now, Miriam, shake hands and forget it all. I was as much to blame as you were, and the shot really did me good. I came out of the hospital as healthy and fit as a cab horse. Come on, that drink's waiting. Old man, said Miriam, brokenly, I don't know how to thank you. Why, well, you know. Oh, forget it, boomed Hedges. Quinby'll die of thirst if we don't join him. Bib was sitting on the shady side of the gallery waiting for the 11 o'clock breakfast. Presently Miriam came out and joined him. His eye was strangely bright. Bib, my boy, said he, slowly waving his hand, do you see those mountains and that sea and sky and sunshine? They're mine, Bibsy, all mine. You go in, said Bib, and take 8 grains of quinine, right away. It won't do in this climate for a man to get to thinking he's Rockefeller, or James O'Neill either. Inside, the purser was untying a great roll of newspapers, many of them weeks old, gathered in the lower ports by the Pajaro to be distributed at casual stopping places. Thus do the beneficent voyagers scatter news and entertainment among the prisoners of sea and mountains. Tio Pancho, the hotel proprietor, set his great silver-rimmed anteojos upon his nose and divided the papers into a number of smaller rolls. A barefooted muchacho dashed in, desiring the post of messenger. Bienvenido, said Tio Pancho. This to Senora Conant, that to El Dr. S.S. Schlegel Dios. What a name to say. That to Senor Davis, one for Don Alberto. These two for the Casa de Huéspedes, numero 6, en la calle de las Buenas Gracias. And say to them all, muchacho, that the Pajaro sails for Panama at 3 this afternoon. If any have letters to send by the post, let them come quickly, that they may first pass through the Correo. Mrs. Conant received her roll of newspapers at 4 o'clock. The boy was late in delivering them, because he had been deflected from his duty by an iguana that crossed his path and to which he immediately gave chase. But it made no hardship, for she had no letters to send. She was idling in a hammock in the patio of the house that she occupied, half awake, half happily dreaming of the paradise that she and Miriam had created out of the wrecks of their pasts. She was content now for the horizon of that shimmering sea to be the horizon of her life. They had shut out the world and closed the door. Miriam was coming to her house at 7, after his dinner at the hotel. She would put on a white dress and an apricot-colored lace mantilla, and they would walk an hour under the coconut palms by the lagoon. She smiled contentedly, and chose a paper at random from the roll the boy had brought. At first the words of a certain headline of a Sunday newspaper meant nothing to her, they conveyed only a visualized sense of familiarity. The largest type ran thus, Lloyd B. Conant secures divorce. And then the subheadings, well-known St. Louis paint manufacturer wins suit, pleading 1 year's absence of wife. Her mysterious disappearance recalled. Nothing has been heard of her since. Twisting herself quickly out of the hammock, Mrs. Conant's eye soon traversed the half column of the recall. It ended thus, it will be remembered that Mrs. Conant disappeared one evening in March of last year. It was freely rumored that her marriage with Lloyd B. Conant resulted in much unhappiness. Stories were not wanting to the effect that his cruelty toward his wife had more than once taken the form of physical abuse. After her departure, a full bottle of tincture of aconite, a deadly poison, was found in a small medicine cabinet in her bedroom. This might have been an indication that she meditated suicide. It is supposed that she abandoned such an intention if she possessed it, and left her home instead. Mrs. Conant slowly dropped the paper, and sat on a chair, clasping her hands tightly. Let me think, oh God. Let me think, she whispered. I took the bottle with me. I threw it out of the window of the train. There was another bottle in the cabinet. There were two, side by side, the aconite and the valerian that I took when I could not sleep. If they found the aconite bottle full, why, but, he is alive, of course I gave him only a harmless dose of valerian. I am not a murderess in fact. Ralph, oh God, don't let this be a dream. She went into the part of the house that she rented from the old Peruvian man and his wife, shut the door, and walked up and down her room swiftly and feverishly for half an hour. Miriam's photograph stood in a frame on a table. She picked it up, looked at it with a smile of exquisite tenderness, and dropped 4 tears on it. And Miriam only 20 rods away. Then she stood still for 10 minutes, looking into space. She looked into space through a slowly opening door. On her side of the door was the building material for a castle of romance love, an arcady of waving palms, a lullaby of waves on the shore of a haven of rest, respite, peace, a lotus land of dreamy ease and security, a life of poetry and heart's ease and refuge. Romanticist, Will you tell me what Mrs. Conant saw on the other side of the door?
You cannot?
That is, you will not?
Very well, then listen.
She saw herself go into a department store and buy 5 spools of silk thread and 3 yards of gingham to make an apron for the cook.
Shall I charge it, ma'am?
Asked the clerk. As she walked out, a lady whom she met greeted her cordially.
Oh, where did you get the pattern for those sleeves, dear Mrs. Conant?
She said. At the corner, a policeman helped her across the street and touched his helmet.
Any callers?
She asked the maid when she reached home.
Mrs. Waldron, answered the maid, and the two Mrs. Jenkinson.
Very well, she said. You may bring me a cup of tea, Maggie.
Mrs. Conant went to the door and called Angela, the old Peruvian woman.
If Mateo is there, send him to me.
Mateo, a half-breed, shuffling and old but efficient, came.
Is there a steamer or a vessel of any kind leaving this coast tonight or tomorrow that I can get passage on?
She asked.
Mateo considered.
At Punta Reina, 30 miles down the coast, Senora, he answered, there is a small steamer loading with cinchona and dyewoods. She sails for San Francisco tomorrow at sunrise.
So says my brother, who arrived in his sloop today, passing by Punta Reina.
You must take me in that sloop to that steamer tonight.
Will you do that?
Perhaps Mateo shrugged a suggestive shoulder.
Mrs. Conant took a handful of money from a drawer and gave it to him.
Get the sloop ready behind the little point of land below the town, she ordered.
Get sailors, and be ready to sail at 6 o'clock.
In half an hour, bring a cart partly filled with straw into the patio here, and take my trunk to the sloop.
There is more money yet.
Now, hurry.
For one time Mateo walked away without shuffling his feet.
Angela, cried Mrs. Conant, almost fiercely, come and help me pack. I am going away.
Out with this trunk.
My clothes first.
Stir yourself.
Those dark dresses first.
Hurry.
From the first she did not waver from her decision. Her view was clear and final. Her door had opened and let the world in. Her love for Miriam was not lessened, but it now appeared a hopeless and unrealizable thing. The visions of their future that had seemed so blissful and complete had vanished. She tried to assure herself that her renunciation was rather for his sake than for her own. Now that she was cleared of her burden at least, technically would not his own weigh too heavily upon him? If she should cling to him, would not the difference forever silently mar and corrode their happiness? Thus she reasoned, but there were 1,000 little voices calling to her that she could feel rather than hear, like the hum of distant, powerful machinery, the little voices of the world, that, when raised in unison, can send their insistent call through the thickest door. Once while packing, a brief shadow of the lotus dream came back to her. She held Miriam's picture to her heart with one hand, while she threw a pair of shoes into the trunk with her other. At 6 o'clock Mateo returned and reported the sloop ready. He and his brother lifted the trunk into the cart, covered it with straw and conveyed it to the point of embarkation. From there they transferred it on board in the sloop story. Then Mateo returned for additional orders. Mrs. Conant was ready. She had settled all business matters with Angela, and was impatiently waiting. She wore a long, loose black silk duster that she often walked about in when the evenings were chilly. On her head was a small round hat, and over it the apricot-colored lace mantilla. Dusk had quickly followed the short twilight. Mateo led her by dark and grass-grown streets toward the point behind which the sloop was anchored. On turning a corner they beheld the Hotel Orilla del Mar 3 streets away, nebulously aglow with its array of kerosene lamps.
Mrs. Conant paused, with streaming eyes.
I must see him once before I go, she murmured in anguish. But even then she did not falter in her decision. Quickly she invented a plan by which she might speak to him, and yet make her departure without his knowing. She would walk past the hotel, ask someone to call him out and talk a few moments on some trivial excuse, leaving him expecting to see her at her home at 7. She unpinned her hat and gave it to Mateo.
Keep this, and wait here till I come, she ordered. Then she draped the mantilla over her head as she usually did when walking after sunset, and went straight to the Orilla del Mar. She was glad to see the bulky, white-clad figure of Tio Pancho standing alone on the gallery.
Tio Pancho, she said, with a charming smile, may I trouble you to ask Mr. Miriam to come out for just a few moments that I may speak with him?
Tio Pancho bowed as an elephant bows.
Buenas tardes, Senora Conant, he said, as a cavalier talks. And then he went on, less at his ease.
But does not the Senora know that Senora Miriam sailed on the Pajaro for Panama at 3 o'clock of this afternoon, too?
The theory in the hound.
Not many days ago my old friend from the tropics, J. P. Bridger, United States Consul on the island of Ratona,
was in the city. We had Wassail and Jubilee and saw the Flatiron Building, and missed seeing the Bronxless Menagerie by about a couple of nights. And then, at the ebb tide, we were walking up a street that parallels and parodies Broadway. A woman with a comely and mundane countenance passed us, holding in leash a wheezing, vicious, waddling, brute of a yellow pug. The dog entangled himself with Bridger's legs and mumbled his ankles in a snarling, peevish, sulky bite. Bridger, with a happy smile, kicked the breath out of the brute. The woman showered us with a quick rain of well-conceived adjectives that left us in no doubt as to our place in her opinion, and we passed on. 10 yards farther, an old woman with disordered white hair and her bank book tucked well hidden beneath her tattered shawl begged. Bridger stopped and disinterred for her a quarter from his holiday waistcoat. On the next corner, a quarter of a ton of well-clothed man with a rice-powdered, fat, white jowl, stood holding the chain of a devil-born bulldog whose forelegs were strangers by the length of a dachshund. A little woman in a last season's hat confronted him and wept, which was plainly all she could do, while he cursed her in low, sweet, practiced tones. Bridger smiled again strictly to himself, and this time he took out a little memorandum book and made a note of it. This he had no right to do without due explanation, and I said so. "It's a new theory," said Bridger, "that I picked up down in Ratona. I've been gathering support for it as I knock about. The world isn't ripe for it yet, but well, I'll tell you, and then you run your mind back along the people you've known and see what you make of it." And so I cornered Bridger in a place where they have artificial palms and wine, and he told me the story, which is here in my words and on his responsibility. One afternoon at 3 o'clock, on the island of Ratona, a boy raced along the beach screaming, "Pajaro, ahoy!" Thus he made known the keenness of his hearing and the justice of his discrimination in pitch. He who first heard and made oral proclamation concerning the toot of an approaching steamer's whistle, and correctly named the steamer, was a small hero in Ratona until the next steamer came. Wherefore, there was rivalry among the barefoot youth of Ratona, and many fell victims to the softly blown conch shells of sloops which, as they enter harbor, sound surprisingly like a distant steamer's signal. And some could name you the vessel when its call, in your duller ears, sounded no louder than the sigh of the wind through the branches of the coconut palms. But today he who proclaimed the Pajaro gained his honors. Ratona bent its ear to listen, and soon the deep-tongued blast grew louder and nearer, and at length Ratona saw above the line of palms on the low point the two black funnels of the fruiter slowly creeping toward the mouth of the harbor. You must know that Ratona is an island 20 miles off the south of a South American republic. It is a port of that republic, and it sleeps sweetly in a smiling sea, toiling not nor spinning, fed by the abundant tropics where all things ripen, cease and fall toward the grave. 800 people dream life away in a green embowered village that follows the horseshoe curve of its Spezia harbor. They are mostly Spanish and Indian mestizos, with a shading of San Domingo Negroes, a lightening of pure-blood Spanish officials and a slight leavening of the froth of 3 or 4 pioneering white races. No steamers touch at Ratona save the fruit steamers which take on their banana inspectors there on their way to the coast. They leave Sunday newspapers, ice, quinine, bacon, watermelons and vaccine matter at the island, and that is about all the touch Ratona gets with the world. The Pajaro paused at the mouth of the harbor, rolling heavily in the swell that sent the whitecaps racing beyond the smooth water inside. Already 2 dories from the village, one conveying fruit inspectors, the other going for what it could get, were halfway out to the steamer. The inspector's dory was taken on board with them, and the Pajaro steamed away for the mainland for its load of fruit. The other boat returned to Ratona bearing a contribution from the Pajaro's store of ice, the usual roll of newspapers, and one passenger, Taylor Plunkett, sheriff of Chatham County, Kentucky. Bridger, the United States consul at Ratona, was cleaning his rifle in the official shandy under a breadfruit tree 20 yards from the water of the harbor. The consul occupied a place somewhat near the tail of his political party's procession. The music of the bandwagon sounded very faintly to him in the distance. The plums of office went to others. Bridger's share of the spoils the consulship at Ratona was little more than a prune, a dried prune from the boarding house department of the public crib. But $900 yearly was opulence in Ratona. Besides, Bridger had contracted a passion for shooting alligators in the lagoons near his consulate, and was not unhappy. He looked up from a careful inspection of his rifle lock and saw a broad man filling his doorway. A broad, noiseless, slow-moving man, sunburnt almost to the brown of Van Dyke. A man of 45. Neatly clothed in homespun, with scanty light hair, a close-clipped brown and gray beard and pale blue eyes expressing mildness and simplicity. "You are Mr. Bridger, the consul," said the broad man. "They directed me here. Can you tell me what those big bunches of things like gourds are in those trees that look like feather dusters along the edge of the water?" "Take that chair," said the consul,
re-oiling his cleaning rag.
No, the other one, that bamboo thing won't hold you.
Why, they're coconut screen coconuts. The shell of them is always a light green before they're ripe.
Much obliged, said the other man, sitting down carefully. I didn't quite like to tell the folks at home they were olives unless I was sure about it. My name is Plunkett. I'm sheriff of Chatham County, Kentucky. I've got extradition papers in my pocket authorizing the arrest of a man on this island. They've been signed by the president of this country, and they're in correct shape. The man's name is Wade Williams. He's in the coconut raising business. What he's wanted for is the murder of his wife 2 years ago. Where can I find him?
The consul squinted an eye and looked through his rifle barrel. There's nobody on the island who calls himself Williams, he remarked.
Didn't suppose there was, said Plunkett mildly. He'll do by any other name.
Besides myself, said Bridger, there are only two Americans on Ratona, Bob Reeves and Henry Morgan.
The man I want sells coconuts, suggested Plunkett.
You see that coconut walk extending up to the point? Said the consul, waving his hand toward the open door. That belongs to Bob Reeves. Henry Morgan owns half the trees to Lord on the island.
1 month ago, said the sheriff, Wade Williams wrote a confidential letter to a man in Chatham County, telling him where he was and how he was getting along. The letter was lost, and the person that found it gave it away. They sent me after him, and I've got the papers. I reckon he's one of your coconut men for certain.
You've got his picture, of course, said Bridger. It might be Reeves or Morgan, but I'd hate to think it. They're both as fine fellows as you'd meet in an all-day auto ride.
No, doubtfully answered Plunkett, there wasn't any picture of Williams to be had. And I never saw him myself. I've been sheriff only a year. But I've got a pretty accurate description of him. About 5'11", dark hair and eyes, nose inclined to be Roman, heavy about the shoulders, strong, white teeth, with none missing, laughs a good deal, talkative, drinks considerably but never to intoxication, looks you square in the eye when talking, age 35. Which one of your men does that description fit?
The consul grinned broadly.
I'll tell you what you do, he said, laying down his rifle and slipping on his dingy black alpaca coat. You come along, Mr. Plunkett, and I'll take you up to see the boys. If you can tell which one of them your description fits better than it does the other, you have the advantage of me.
Bridger conducted the sheriff out and along the hard beach close to which the tiny houses of the village were distributed. Immediately back of the town rose sudden, small, thickly wooded hills. Up one of these, by means of steps cut in the hard clay, the consul led Plunkett. On the very verge of an eminence was perched a two-room wooden cottage with a thatched roof. A Carib woman was washing clothes outside. The consul ushered the sheriff to the door of the room that overlooked the harbor. Two men were in the room, about to sit down, in their shirt sleeves, to a table spread for dinner. They bore little resemblance one to the other in detail, but the general description given by Plunkett could have been justly applied to either. In height, color of hair, shape of nose, build and manners, each of them tallied with it. They were fair types of jovial, ready-witted, broad-gauged Americans who had gravitated together for companionship in an alien land.
Hello, Bridger, they called in unison at sight of the consul. Come and have dinner with us. And then they noticed Plunkett at his heels, and came forward with hospitable curiosity.
Gentlemen, said the consul, his voice taking on unaccustomed formality, this is Mr. Plunkett. Mr. Plunkett, Mr. Reeves and Mr. Morgan.
The coconut barons greeted the newcomer joyously. Reeves seemed about an inch taller than Morgan, but his laugh was not quite as loud. Morgan's eyes were deep brown, Reeves's were black. Reeves was the host and busied himself with fetching other chairs and calling to the Carib woman for supplemental tableware. It was explained that Morgan lived in a bamboo shack to Lord, but that every day the two friends dined together. Plunkett stood still during the preparations, looking about mildly with his pale blue eyes. Bridger looked apologetic and uneasy. At length two other covers were laid and the company was assigned to places. Reeves and Morgan stood side by side across the table from the visitors. Reeves nodded genially as a signal for all to seat themselves. And then suddenly Plunkett raised his hand with a gesture of authority. He was looking straight between Reeves and Morgan.
Wade Williams, he said quietly, you're under arrest for murder.
Reeves and Morgan instantly exchanged a quick, bright glance, the quality of which was interrogation, with the seasoning of surprise. Then, simultaneously they turned to the speaker with a puzzled and frank deprecation in their gaze.
Can't say that we understand you, Mr. Plunkett, said Morgan, cheerfully. Did you say Williams?
What's the joke, Bridgie? Asked Reeves, turning, to the consul with a smile.
Before Bridger could answer, Plunkett spoke again.
"I'll explain," he said, quietly. "One of you don't need any explanation, but this is for the other one. One of you is Wade Williams of Chatham County, Kentucky. You murdered your wife on May 5, 2 years ago, after ill-treating and abusing her continually for 5 years. I have the proper papers in my pocket for taking you back with me, and you are going. We will return on the fruit steamer that comes back by the Silent tomorrow to leave its inspectors. I acknowledge, gentlemen, that I'm not quite sure which one of you is Williams. But Wade Williams goes back to Chatham County tomorrow. I want you to understand that." A great sound of merry laughter from Morgan and Reeves went out over the still harbor. Two or three fishermen in the fleet of sloops anchored there looked up at the house of the Diablos Americanos on the hill and wondered.
"My dear Mr. Plunkett," cried Morgan, conquering his mirth, "the dinner is getting cold. Let us sit down and eat. I am anxious to get my spoon into that shark fin soup. Business afterward."
"Sit down, gentlemen, if you please," added Reeves, pleasantly. "I am sure Mr. Plunkett will not object. Perhaps a little time may be of advantage to him in identifying the gentleman he wishes to arrest."
"No objections, I'm sure," said Plunkett, dropping into his chair heavily. "I'm hungry myself. I didn't want to accept the hospitality of you folks without giving you notice, that's all."
Reeves set bottles and glasses on the table. "There's cognac," he said, "and anisada, and scotch smoke, and rye. Take your choice."
Bridger chose rye, Reeves poured three fingers of scotch for himself, Morgan took the same. The sheriff, against much protestation, filled his glass from the water bottle.
"Here's to the appetite," said Reeves, raising his glass, "of Mr. Williams." Morgan's laugh and his drink encountering sent him into a choking sputter. All began to pay attention to the dinner, which was well cooked and palatable.
"Williams," called Plunkett, suddenly and sharply. All looked up wonderingly. Reeves found the sheriff's mild eye resting upon him. He flushed a little.
"See here," he said, with some asperity, "my name's Reeves, and I don't want you to—" but the comedy of the thing came to his rescue, and he ended with a laugh.
"I suppose, Mr. Plunkett," said Morgan, carefully seasoning an alligator pear, "that you are aware of the fact that you'll import a good deal of trouble for yourself into Kentucky if you take back the wrong man, that is, of course, if you take anybody back?"
"Thank you for the salt," said the sheriff. "Oh, I'll take somebody back. It'll be one of you two gentlemen. Yes, I know I'd get stuck for damages if I make a mistake. But I'm going to try to get the right man."
"I'll tell you what you do," said Morgan, leaning forward with a jolly twinkle in his eyes. "You take me. I'll go without any trouble. The coconut business hasn't panned out well this year, and I'd like to make some extra money out of your bondsman."
"That's not fair," chimed in Reeves. "I got only $16 a thousand for my last shipment. Take me, Mr. Plunkett."
"I'll take Wade Williams," said the sheriff, patiently, "or I'll come pretty close to it."
"It's like dining with a ghost," remarked Morgan, with a pretended shiver. "The ghost of a murderer, too. Will somebody pass the toothpicks to the shade of the naughty Mr. Williams?"
Plunkett seemed as unconcerned as if he were dining at his own table in Chatham County. He was a gallant trencherman, and the strange tropic viands tickled his palate. Heavy, commonplace, almost slothful in his movements, he appeared to be devoid of all the cunning and watchfulness of the sleuth. He even ceased to observe, with any sharpness or attempted discrimination, the two men, one of whom he had undertaken with surprising self-confidence, to drag away upon the serious charge of wife murder. Here, indeed, was a problem set before him that if wrongly solved would have amounted to a serious discomfiture, yet there he sat puzzling his soul, to all appearances, over the novel flavor of a broiled iguana cutlet. The consul felt a decided discomfort. Reeves and Morgan were his friends and pals, yet the sheriff from Kentucky had a certain right to his official aid and moral support. So Bridger sat the silentest around the board and tried to estimate the peculiar situation. His conclusion was that both Reeves and Morgan, quick-witted, as he knew them to be, had conceived at the moment of Plunkett's disclosure of his mission and in the brief space of a lightning flash the idea that the other might be the guilty Williams, and that each of them had decided in that moment loyally to protect his comrade against the doom that threatened him. This was the consul's theory, and if he had been a bookmaker at a race of wits for life and liberty, he would have offered heavy odds against the plotting sheriff from Chatham County, Kentucky. When the meal was concluded, the Carib woman came and removed the dishes and cloth. Reeves strewed the table with excellent cigars, and Plunkett, with the others, lighted one of these with evident gratification.
"I may be dull," said Morgan, with a grin and a wink at Bridger, "but I want to know if I am. Now, I say this is all a joke of Mr. Plunkett's,
concocted to frighten two babes in the woods. Is this Williamson to be taken seriously or not?
Williams, corrected Plunkett gravely. I never got off any jokes in my life. I know I wouldn't travel 2,000 miles to get off a poor one as this would be if I didn't take Wade Williams back with me.
Gentlemen, continued the sheriff, now letting his mild eyes travel impartially from one of the company to another, see if you can find any joke in this case. Wade Williams is listening to the words I utter now, but out of politeness, I will speak of him as a third person. For 5 years he made his wife lead the life of a dog. No, I'll take that back. No dog in Kentucky was ever treated as she was. He spent the money that she brought him, spent it at races, at the card table and on horses and hunting. He was a good fellow to his friends, but a cold, sullen demon at home. He wound up the 5 years of neglect by striking her with his closed hand, a hand as hard as a stone, when she was ill and weak from suffering. She died the next day, and he skipped. That's all there is to it. It's enough. I never saw Williams, but I knew his wife. I'm not a man to tell half. She and I were keeping company when she met him. She went to Louisville on a visit and saw him there. I'll admit that he spoiled my chances in no time. I lived then on the edge of the Cumberland Mountains. I was elected sheriff of Chatham County a year after Wade Williams killed his wife. My official duty sends me out here after him, but I'll admit that there's personal feeling, too. And he's going back with me. Mr. Reeves, will you pass me a match?
Awfully imprudent of Williams, said Morgan, putting his feet up against the wall, to strike a Kentucky lady. Seems to me I've heard they were scrappers.
Bad, bad Williams, said Reeves, pouring out more scotch. The two men spoke lightly, but the consul saw and felt the tension and the carefulness in their actions and words. Good old fellows, he said to himself, they're both all right. Each of them is standing by the other like a little brick church. And then a dog walked into the room where they sat, a black and tan hound, long-eared, lazy, confident of welcome. Plunkett turned his head and looked at the animal, which halted, confidently, within a few feet of his chair. Suddenly the sheriff, with a deep-mouthed oath, left his seat and bestowed upon the dog a vicious and heavy kick, with his ponderous shoe. The hound, heartbroken, astonished, with flapping ears and incurved tail, uttered a piercing yelp of pain and surprise. Reeves and the consul remained in their chairs, saying nothing, but astonished at the unexpected show of intolerance from the easygoing man from Chatham County. But Morgan, with a suddenly purpling face, leapt to his feet and raised a threatening arm above the guest. You brute! He shouted, passionately, why did you do that? Quickly the amenities returned, Plunkett muttered some indistinct apology and regained his seat. Morgan with a decided effort controlled his indignation and also returned to his chair. And then Plunkett with the spring of a tiger, leapt around the corner of the table and snapped handcuffs on the paralyzed Morgan's wrists. Hound lover and woman killer! He cried, get ready to meet your God! When Bridger had finished I asked him. Did he get the right man?
He did, said the consul.
And how did he know? I inquired, being in a kind of bewilderment. When he put Morgan in the dory, answered Bridger, the next day to take him aboard the Pajaro, this man Plunkett stopped to shake hands with me and I asked him the same question. Mr. Bridger, said he, I'm a Kentuckian, and I've seen a great deal of both men and animals. And I never yet saw a man that was over fond of horses and dogs but what was cruel to women. 3. The hypotheses of failure. Lawyer Gooch bestowed his undivided attention upon the engrossing arts of his profession. But one flight of fancy did he allow his mind to entertain. He was fond of likening his suite of office rooms to the bottom of a ship. The rooms were 3 in number, with a door opening from one to another. These doors could also be closed. Ships, Lawyer Gooch would say, are constructed for safety, with separate, watertight compartments in their bottoms. If one compartment springs a leak it fills with water, but the good ship goes on unhurt. Were it not for the separating bulkheads one leak would sink the vessel. Now it often happens that while I am occupied with clients, other clients with conflicting interests call. With the assistance of Archibald, an office boy with a future, I cause the dangerous influx to be diverted into separate compartments, while I sound with my legal plummet the depth of each. If necessary, they may be bailed into the hallway and permitted to escape by way of the stairs, which we may term the lee scuppers. Thus the good ship of business is kept afloat, whereas if the element that supports her were allowed to mingle freely in her hold we might be swamped. Ha, ha, ha. The law is dry. Good jokes are few. Surely it might be permitted Lawyer Gooch to mitigate the bore of briefs, the tedium of torts and the prosiness of processes with even so light a levy upon the good property of humor.
Lawyer Gooch's practice leaned largely to the settlement of marital infelicities. Did matrimony languish through complications, he mediated, soothed and arbitrated. Did it suffer from implications, he readjusted, defended and championed. Did it arrive at the extremity of duplications, he always got light sentences for his clients. But not always was Lawyer Gooch the keen, armed, wily belligerent, ready with his two-edged sword to lop off the shackles of Hyman. He had been known to build up instead of demolishing, to reunite instead of severing, to lead erring and foolish ones back into the fold instead of scattering the flock. Often had he by his eloquent and moving appeals sent husband and wife, weeping, back into each other's arms. Frequently he had coached childhood so successfully that, at the psychological moment, and at a given signal, the plaintive pipe of Papa, won't you come home a day into me and mother? Had won the day and upheld the pillars of a tottering home. Unprejudiced persons admitted that Lawyer Gooch received as big fees from these re-yoked clients as would have been paid him had the cases been contested in court. Prejudiced ones intimated that his fees were doubled, because the penitent couples always came back later for the divorce, anyhow. There came a season in June when the legal ship of Lawyer Gooch, to borrow his own figure, was nearly becalmed. The divorce mill grinds slowly in June. It is the month of Cupid and Hymen. Lawyer Gooch, then, sat idle in the middle room of his clientless suite. A small anteroom connected or rather separated this apartment from the hallway. Here was stationed Archibald, who wrested from visitors their cards or oral nomenclature which he bore to his master while they waited. Suddenly, on this day, there came a great knocking at the outermost door. Archibald, opening it, was thrust aside as superfluous by the visitor, who without due reverence at once penetrated to the office of Lawyer Gooch and threw himself with good-natured insolence into a comfortable chair facing the gentleman. "You are Phineas C. Gooch, attorney at law?" said the visitor, his tone of voice and inflection making his words at once a question, an assertion and an accusation. Before committing himself by a reply, the lawyer estimated his possible client in one of his brief but shrewd and calculating glances. The man was of the emphatic type, large-sized, active, bold and debonair in demeanor, vain beyond a doubt, slightly swaggering, ready and at ease. He was well clothed, but with a shade too much ornateness. He was seeking a lawyer, but if that fact would seem to saddle him with troubles, they were not patent in his beaming eye and courageous air. "My name is Gooch," at length the lawyer admitted. Upon pressure he would also have confessed to the Phineas C., but he did not consider it good practice to volunteer information. "I did not receive your card," he continued, by way of rebuke, "so I—" "I know you didn't," remarked the visitor, coolly, "and you won't just yet. Light up?" He threw a leg over an arm of his chair, and tossed a handful of rich-hued cigars upon the table. Lawyer Gooch knew the brand. He thought just enough to accept the invitation to smoke. "You are a divorce lawyer," said the cardless visitor. This time there was no interrogation in his voice. Nor did his words constitute a simple assertion. They formed a charge, a denunciation, as one would say to a dog, "You are a dog." Lawyer Gooch was silent under the imputation. "You handle," continued the visitor, "all the various ramifications of busted-up connubiality. You're a surgeon, we might saw, who extracts Cupid's darts when he shoots them into the wrong parties. You furnish patent, incandescent lights for premises where the torch of Hyman has burned so low you can't light a cigar at it. Am I right, Mr. Gooch?" "I have undertaken cases," said the lawyer, guardedly, "in the line to which your figurative speech seems to refer. Do you wish to consult me professionally, Mr.—" The lawyer paused, with significance. "Not yet," said the other, with an arch wave of his cigar, "not just yet. Let us approach the subject with the caution that should have been used in the original act that makes this powwow necessary. There exists a matrimonial jumble to be straightened out. But before I give you names I want your honest, well, anyhow, your professional opinion on the merits of the mix-up. I want you to size up the catastrophe abstractly, you understand? I'm Mr. Nobody, and I've got a story to tell you. Then you say what's what. Do you get my wireless?" "You want to state a hypothetical case?" suggested Lawyer Gooch. "That's the word I was after. Apothecary was the best shot I could make at it in my mind. The hypothetical goes. I'll state the case. Suppose there's a woman, a deuced fine-looking woman who has run away from her husband and home. She's badly mashed on another man who went to her town to work up some real estate business. Now, we may as well call this woman's husband Thomas R. Billings, for that's his name. I'm giving you straight tips on the cognomens. The Lothario chap is Henry K. Jessup. The Billingses lived in a little town called Susanville, a good many miles from here. Now, Jessup leaves Susanville 2 weeks ago. The next day Mrs. Billings follows him.
She's dead gone on this man Jessup, you can bet your law library on that.
Lawyer Gooch's client said this with such unctuous satisfaction that even the callous lawyer experienced a slight ripple of repulsion. He now saw clearly in his fatuous visitor the conceit of the lady killer, the egoistic complacency of the successful trifler.
Now, continued the visitor, suppose this Mrs. Billings wasn't happy at home? We'll say she and her husband didn't gee worth a cent. They've got incompatibility to burn. The things she likes, Billings wouldn't have as a gift with trading stamps. It's Tabby and Rover with him all the time. She's an educated woman in science and culture, and she reads things out loud at meetings. Billings is not on. He don't appreciate progress and obelisks and ethics, and things of that sort. Old Billings is simply a blink when it comes to such things. The lady is out and out above his class. Now, lawyer, don't it look like a fair equalization of rights and wrongs that a woman like that should be allowed to throw down Billings and take the man that can appreciate her?
Incompatibility, said Lawyer Gooch, is undoubtedly the source of much marital discord and unhappiness. Where it is positively proved, divorce would seem to be the equitable remedy. Are you, excuse me, is this man Jessup one to whom the lady may safely trust her future?
Oh, you can bet on Jessup, said the client, with a confident wag of his head. Jessup's all right. He'll do the square thing.
Why, he left Susanville just to keep people from talking about Mrs. Billings. But she followed him up, and now, of course, he'll stick to her. When she gets a divorce, all legal and proper, Jessup will do the proper thing.
And now, said Lawyer Gooch, continuing the hypothesis, if you prefer, and supposing that my services should be desired in the case, what?
The client rose impulsively to his feet.
Oh, dang the hypothetical business, he exclaimed, impatiently. Let's let her drop, and get down to straight talk. You ought to know who I am by this time. I want that woman to have her divorce. I'll pay for it. The day you set Mrs. Billings free, I'll pay you $500.
Lawyer Gooch's client banged his fist upon the table to punctuate his generosity.
If that is the case, began the lawyer.
Lady to see you, sir, bawled Archibald, bouncing in from his anteroom. He had orders to always announce immediately any client that might come. There was no sense in turning business away.
Lawyer Gooch took client number one by the arm and led him suavely into one of the adjoining rooms.
Favor me by remaining here a few minutes, sir, said he. I will return and resume our consultation with the least possible delay. I am rather expecting a visit from a very wealthy old lady in connection with a will. I will not keep you waiting long. The breezy gentleman seated himself with obliging acquiescence, and took up a magazine. The lawyer returned to the middle office, carefully closing behind him the connecting door.
Show the lady in, Archibald, he said to the office boy, who was awaiting the order.
A tall lady, of commanding presence and sternly handsome, entered the room. She wore a robes, not clothes ample and fluid. In her eye could be perceived the lambent flame of genius and soul. In her hand was a green bag of the capacity of a bushel, and an umbrella that also seemed to wear a robe, ample and fluid. She accepted a chair.
Are you Mr. Phineas C. Gooch, the lawyer? She asked, in formal and unconciliatory tones.
I am, answered Lawyer Gooch, without circumlocution. He never circumlocuted when dealing with a woman. Women circumlocute. Time is wasted when both sides in debate employ the same tactics.
As a lawyer, sir, began the lady, you may have acquired some knowledge of the human heart. Do you believe that the pusillanimous and petty conventions of our artificial social life should stand as an obstacle in the way of a noble and affectionate heart when it finds its true mate among the miserable and worthless wretches in the world that are called men?
Madam, said Lawyer Gooch, in the tone that he used in curbing his female clients, this is an office for conducting the practice of law. I am a lawyer, not a philosopher, nor the editor of an Answers to the Lovelorn column of a newspaper. I have other clients waiting. I will ask you kindly to come to the point.
Well, you needn't get so stiff around the gills about it, said the lady, with a snap of her luminous eyes and a startling gyration of her umbrella. Business is what I've come for. I want your opinion in the matter of a suit for divorce, as the vulgar would call it, but which is really only the readjustment of the false and ignoble conditions that the short-sighted laws of man have interposed between a loving.
I beg your pardon, madam, interrupted Lawyer Gooch, with some impatience, for reminding you again that this is a law office. Perhaps Mrs. Wilcox.
Mrs. Wilcox is all right, cut in the lady, with a hint of asperity. And so are Tolstoy, and Mrs. Gertrude Atherton, and Omar Khayyam, and Mr. Edward Bach. I've read 'em all.
I would like to discuss with you the divine right of the soul as opposed to the freedom-destroying restrictions of a bigoted and narrow-minded society. But I will proceed to business. I would prefer to lay the matter before you in an impersonal way until you pass upon its merits. That is to describe it as a supposable instance, without.
You wish to state a hypothetical case? Said Lawyer Gooch.
I was going to say that, said the lady, sharply. Now, suppose there is a woman who is all soul and heart and aspirations for a complete existence. This woman has a husband who is far below her in intellect, in taste and everything. Bah! He is a brute. He despises literature. He sneers at the lofty thoughts of the world's great thinkers. He thinks only of real estate and such sordid things. He is no mate for a woman with soul. We will say that this unfortunate wife one day meets with her ideal a man with brain and heart and force. She loves him. Although this man feels the thrill of a newfound affinity, he is too noble, too honorable to declare himself. He flies from the presence of his beloved. She flies after him, trampling, with superb indifference, upon the fetters with which an unenlightened social system would bind her. Now, what will a divorce cost? Eliza Antimmons, the poetess of Sycamore Gap, got one for $340. Can this lady I speak of get one that cheap?
Madam, said Lawyer Gooch, your last two or three sentences delight me with their intelligence and clearness. Can we not now abandon the hypothetical and come down to names and business?
I should say so, exclaimed the lady, adopting the practical with admirable readiness. Thomas R. Billings is the name of the low brute who stands between the happiness of his legal, but not his spiritual wife and Henry K. Jessup, the noble man whom nature intended for her mate. I, concluded the client, with an air of dramatic revelation, and Mrs. Billings.
Gentlemen to see you, sir, shouted Archibald, invading the room almost at a handspring.
Lawyer Gooch rose from his chair.
Mrs. Billings, he said courteously, allow me to conduct you into the adjoining office apartment for a few minutes. I am expecting a very wealthy old gentleman on business connected with a will. In a very short while I will join you, and continue our consultation.
With his accustomed chivalrous manner, Lawyer Gooch ushered his soulful client into the remaining unoccupied room, and came out, closing the door with circumspection. The next visitor introduced by Archibald was a thin, nervous, irritable-looking man of middle age, with a worried and apprehensive expression of countenance. He carried in one hand a small satchel, which he set down upon the floor beside the chair which the lawyer placed for him. His clothing was of good quality, but it was worn without regard to neatness or style, and appeared to be covered with the dust of travel.
You make a specialty of divorce cases, he said, in an agitated but business-like tone.
I may say, began Lawyer Gooch, that my practice has not altogether avoided.
I know you do, interrupted client number three. You needn't tell me. I've heard all about you. I have a case to lay before you without necessarily disclosing any connection that I might have with it, that is.
You'll wish, said Lawyer Gooch, to state a hypothetical case.
You may call it that. I am a plain man of business. I will be as brief as possible. We will first take up hypothetical woman. We will say she is married uncongenially. In many ways she is a superior woman. Physically she is considered to be handsome. She is devoted to what she calls literature, poetry and prose, and such stuff. Her husband is a plain man in the business walks of life. Their home has not been happy, although the husband has tried to make it so. Some time ago a man, a stranger, came to the peaceful town in which they lived and engaged in some real estate operations. This woman met him, and became unaccountably infatuated with him. Her attentions became so open that the man felt the community to be no safe place for him, so he left it. She abandoned husband and home, and followed him. She forsook her home, where she was provided with every comfort, to follow this man who had inspired her with such a strange affection. Is there anything more to be deplored, concluded the client, in a trembling voice, than the wrecking of a home by a woman's uncalculating folly?
Lawyer Gooch delivered the cautious opinion that there was not.
This man she has gone to join, resumed the visitor, is not the man to make her happy. It is a wild and foolish self-deception that makes her think he will. Her husband, in spite of their many disagreements, is the only one capable of dealing with her sensitive and peculiar nature. But this she does not realize now.
Would you consider a divorce the logical cure in the case you present? Asked Lawyer Gooch, who felt that the conversation was wandering too far from the field of business.
A divorce! Exclaimed the client, feelingly, almost tearfully.
No, not that. I have read, Mr. Gooch, of many instances where your sympathy and kindly interest led you to act as a mediator between an estranged husband and wife.